seems like only a week ago, the whole world wondered whether the U.S. could meet its own goals for getting Americans and our Afghan friends and allies out of the reach of the Taliban. And that's because it was only a week ago. Actually, less than that. Even tonight, the answer is clear, and it is yes, maybe. Jaw-dropping numbers on the airlift, but now there is a new question. How long can we keep this pace up? The president says, not very. And America's airlines are reporting for duty to the Pentagon tonight on Banfield.
We are currently on a pace to finish by August the 31st. The sooner we can finish, the better. Each day of operations brings added risk to our troops.
Hello and welcome to Banfield. That is the commander-in-chief today, in no mood to push back his own deadline for wrapping up this airlift from Kabul airport and bringing home the troops and planes responsible for it. It is impossible to know whether they really are on a pace to finish, because we still don't really know with any certainty how many Americans had been or still are trying to get out. And numbers of Afghans who want to leave, though surely far higher, are even harder to estimate. Still, the numbers flown out this week alone, and it is only Tuesday, are staggering. At the White House today, the president announced more than 70,000 people have left Afghanistan since the fall of Kabul just 10 days ago. Yesterday alone, more than 21,000 people came out, almost doubling the figure from the day before, which itself was more than the highest one-day objective a week ago. So why not keep it up? Why not keep this pace until no one is left waiting at Kabul airport wanting to escape? Kabul airport is known as HKIA. Even many Democrats are asking that question. What about HKIA? And they are balking at Biden's deadline.
It's hard for me to imagine all of that can be accomplished between now and the end of the month.
For its part, the Taliban is 1,000% behind that August 31st deadline for Americans in uniform and otherwise to get out. A spokesman drove that home in a news conference, adding that Afghan citizens should no longer even attempt to reach HKIA. He said for their own safety. Regardless, for good measure, they just went ahead and shut the road. The Taliban just shut the road to the airport for any Afghans who want to leave or not. Back at the White House, the president admitted that the Taliban is a factor in his decision-making, but not the only factor.
Every day we're on the ground is another day we know that ISIS-K is seeking to target the airport and attack both U.S. and allied forces and innocent civilians. Additionally, thus far, the Taliban have been taking steps to work with us so we can get our people out. But it's a tenuous situation.
So here is what a tenuous situation actually looks like on the ground. By the way, an RPG on the shoulder of a Taliban fighter, right on the grounds of the airport, that is not something you would normally see. Even worse are heat-seeking missiles, which the Taliban has, and guess who else has? ISIS-K. ISIS-K is ISIS in Afghanistan. And the U.S. and allied pilots are now attempting to counter those heat-seeking missiles by shooting these off. Take a look. Look at your screen. Flares being shot off right after takeoff. Ideally, the idea would be that the missile would follow the heat of the flare instead of the heat of the plane. That is jarring to see that. But even in times like these, where you watch flares being shot out from a C-17 with a belly full of innocent civilians just so that someone won't shoot it down. Even in times like these, a quiet word can sometimes do a lot more. And thus we learn of this. An unannounced and very secret visit by the director of the CIA, William Burns, to the Taliban leader, a man named Abdul Ghani Baradar. Mullah Baradar, as he's also known, returned to Afghanistan here. Take a look at these pictures. This was just, less than a half of a week ago. But before that, he was in the Gulf negotiating with the Trump administration. And here were the pictures in Qatar. And before these pretty pictures were taken, he spent 8 years in a Pakistani prison after being arrested by, I think you can complete this picture, the CIA, the very people he was meeting with today. Just imagine that greeting. And I have talked long enough. It's time to hear from my guests. Michael Isikoff has covered wars and politics as long as I have, and maybe a little longer, and that's saying something. You've seen his work on NBC, in Newsweek, and now on Yahoo News, where he's the chief investigative correspondent. Doug High is a former RNC communications director and was deputy chief of staff to the former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. He's also a friend. Connor Powell is a journalist who lived in Kabul for 4 years, and he knows the lay of the land there. He's been heavily involved with his journalist wife in helping rescue Afghan civilians and even U.S. commandos. And Steve Russell is a former GOP congressman from Oklahoma and retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. He served in the early days of the Afghan war and in Iraq. His unit, in fact, was instrumental in capturing Saddam Hussein, of all people. Welcome to all four of you, and what a panel this is. It's perfect. I'm going to start with the reporter in the bunch. Connor, walk me through the SIT report. And the SIT report is the common speak among the military for situation on the ground as it stands right now.
So it's still a mess, but it's an improving mess from what we can get from both the Pentagon and the White House, and also from talking to contacts on the ground. It started as a very slow evacuation, has really ramped up. I mean, they have made significant progress in evacuating people here in the last really 72 hours or so. It really picked up over the weekend. It's still a security nightmare out there. And in terms of talking to Afghans who are still trying to get out, there isn't a process. The people who have gotten out that we've spoken to, other journalists, myself, they're the ones who've gone outside the airport. They've waited for 30 hours, sometimes longer, and they've just sort of waited until the gates get open. I know people who have filled out forms and submitted paperwork, and they're still waiting at home for an email. A lot of these are the special immigrant visa applicants, people who were, translators in Afghanistan for the U.S. and coalition forces. And a lot of them are the ones who are still waiting to get out. A lot of the people who have already gotten out now in terms of the Afghans are people who just pushed their way forward. And so the administration deserves some credit for really ramping this up, particularly the Pentagon, the last 72 hours. But, you know, they're not even close to dealing with the chaos that this evacuation has caused. And I think it's important to point out that they have this August 31st deadline, which is about a week or so away. And if you think about it, they've spent more time planning for the exit of this evacuation than the Biden administration did planning for the actual withdrawal of Afghanistan over the course of the last couple months.
So, Lieutenant Colonel Russell, I'm going to ask you a multi-part question because of your military background. My God, 21,000 evacuated in 24 hours and 11,000 the day before that. If we can go back, I'm going to ask the control room to show one of those or several of those pictures of all those people sitting in the belly of the C-17s. Those planes are not meant to carry people like this. This is now what you call jam as many in as you can, because we are literally against the clock. It wasn't supposed to be like this. But even if it is like this, Lieutenant Colonel, can they get enough people out in the next 7 days? And when I say people, I mean people in uniform as well.
We certainly have to pray for the safety of the people operating the aircraft. It's a great credit to our military that we've seen so many get out. But mechanical failures, one mishap, weather can be a factor, although they are certainly capable of getting great capacity out. Weight is not a problem in the number of people because of the things that they can haul. Volume would be. We should also point out, though, that it's not the end of the journey for those that even make it out. There are reliable reports in Qatar that there's a great logjam and problem, even bordering on humanity, a humanitarian issue in how they're suffering with water, toilet facilities, a number of things. And you have to remember, it's August in that part of the world, extremely hot. So real credit goes to our military for what they're doing there. if they can keep the airport open and our allies as well, there's great capacity, as we saw here in the last 24 hours.
Doug Hay, weigh in on something that Senator Ben Sasse said earlier today, and that was damn the deadline, the August 31st deadline. That's awfully convenient to say America first and damn the deadline, but there are nuances here, and everybody is walking on eggshells while negotiating with a group called the Taliban, who have not been known to be real honest to their word, and why should they? They won the war. So, is this really the time to be chirping from the cheap seats and yelling political slogans? Should all Americans be on the same front here until we've got our people out?
Well, certainly there's always going to be yelling from the cheap seats, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. We've actually had two members of Congress who went to Afghanistan today, a Democrat and a Republican, to get a firsthand look at what's going on. They're reporting that we're seeing right now what they're hearing and seeing up close is not good. And part of that goes to the deadline, where both a Republican and a Democrat want to get the deadline moved back. They feel it's artificially done or arbitrarily done. And that's also where our allies are. And I think it's one of the real problems for this administration right now, whether it's the Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson, whether it's the leader in Germany or France. Our allies are nervous about what we've done, about the deadline not working. And part of the problem, I think, Ashley, is here. You know, one of the things we were promised, a central Joe Biden promise, was that he and his team of pros wouldn't make mistakes and have calamitous world events like Donald Trump and his cast of the Adams family staff that he had. And the reality is our allies and our adversaries are looking at America right now in a much weakened position. And that's not anything that anybody, I think, really would have predicted with Joe Biden, given his long experience in foreign policy.
Well, I would venture to say I've been following this war pretty carefully, having walked through those streets where those men are driving. And it's a 20-year problem, not just a 20-day problem. So, Michael Isikoff, I always think of you as the big picture guy. And in this big picture question, I want you to assess for a moment the realities of the CIA director going in to negotiate with the mullah who's been locked away in Pakistan by the CIA for 8 years, with this added little nugget. And that is that there is a grave fear among the Americans and the Talibs that there's a new guy in town, and that is called ISIS-K. It's the Afghan equivalent of ISIS. They want a piece of that real estate. They failed with their caliphate over in Syria, and they want a piece of it here. They are fighting the Taliban, and I have heard the old expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Is it possible that Americans could actually work with the Taliban because they are both facing ISIS now?
Well, look, among the many, many ironies, sad ironies of all this is what was President Biden's, you know, fundamental justification for pulling the troops out? We had achieved our purpose. We had gone in there because of a terrorist threat from Al-Qaeda. We had rid the country of that terrorist threat. And that was the assertion and explanation back in April. And here we are in August, and the president basically acknowledged today we had to get out right away because of a terrorist threat in Afghanistan. So, you know, clearly we had not achieved the kind of purpose. Yes, we had gotten rid of Osama bin Laden and diminished Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not gone from Afghanistan in any way. But radical jihadis have embraced the Taliban victory all around the world. They've celebrated it. And there's every expectation in the intelligence community that this is going to embolden terrorist groups, whether they be Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other radical jihadi groups. And that's going to be one consequence of our withdrawal here. And I just want to say something else. You know, the sort of blurring of the lines here. Yes, we should all be complimenting the U.S. military for the superb job they're doing in getting tens of thousands of mostly Americans out. But it's pretty clear, and that the tens of thousands, if not 100,000 or more Afghans who were our allies, who worked with us, who were our partners, who were our interpreters, who worked at the embassy, they're not going to get out. And the administration, it's not at all clear they ever planned to get them out. What was the president's justification for why this seems so chaotic? The explanation was that nobody had predicted the Afghan military would fold and the Afghan government would flee in such a short time period. But everybody expected it was likely to happen. And it was likely to happen, whether it be in a few months or more. And how were we ever going to get those Afghan partners out once the government fell and we were gone? They had no
Well, we're 1 week, right? We're 1 week until the deadline. Yes. And if you think about the need for the retrograde, it could take several days. So who knows? Let's say at 20,000 people every day for 5 days, there's 100,000 still to come. We're all crossing our fingers. Gentlemen, all stay put for a moment. I have to squeeze in a quick break, but there's this expression I keep hearing, and that is that the military will be in retrograde. What does that look like? How do you get them out? Because if all the civilians are gone and it's just the soldiers on the plane, aren't they fair game for those RPGs? Or is there a better way? We're going to talk about that in a moment. Stay with us. We are 1 week away from President Biden's deadline, wholly endorsed by the Taliban, but not a whole lot of other people, to wrap up the U.S. airlift from Kabul and bring home our planes, our troops, of course, our people and our gear. Joining me again, veteran journalist Michael Isikoff, GOP commentator Doug High, journalist and former Kabul resident Connor Powell, and former GOP congressman and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Steve Russell. And Lieutenant Colonel, I'm going to start with you. That tease before break was how to get the military in retrograde. How do you get 6,000 soldiers and the very important gear you don't want the Taliban to have back when you're really trying to load every plane with desperate people? Do you start mixing military and people so that it is not just vulnerable soldiers on their way out in those aircraft at the end?
Well, I think obviously we don't want to convey exactly what the evacuation plan would be or how we would echelon our own forces out. But you can bet that we will use all means necessary to evacuate ourselves. Taliban also stands to lose should they see a situation develop where there's fighting going on. That would only invite our presence in, and then it would allow an extension and use of military force. The Taliban, they don't need that or want that. I think also in the negotiations, with today's reports of them blocking access to the airport for anything but foreigners, that is not in keeping with the agreement. So I think there is some wiggle room for negotiation on that basis to try to open back up the airport. But the military will be capable. We are doing a decision now with the military based upon what our political leaders have asked. However, what you'll find is that they will use any means necessary to defend themselves and evacuate their people.
I still find these pictures so fascinating, seeing those flares being fired off as a, as a decoy, basically, of heat for any heat-seeking missiles to follow instead of those missiles hitting the planes themselves. While we're looking at those pictures, Connor Powell, the issue, I think, for it seems the Taliban leader who says we are shutting down the arteries that bring people out of the city and into the airport if they are Afghan, it seems is a brain drain problem. They're losing all the good people. They're losing all the educated. They're losing the doctors. They're losing the lawyers. They're losing the people that would make a new Afghanistan work. And, well, of course, that would be obvious. But will this be an iron curtain? Will there be no way for them ever to get out after this? Is there any thought as to what happens after the Americans are out of Hechkaya?
I know I've talked to a lot of Afghans who are, for various reasons, unable to get to the airport now and wait outside. And they are betting, they're banking on the fact that There's going to be windows to travel from there that countries like Pakistan or Dubai or Doha and Qatar will still be destinations that they can fly to. And there are a lot of Afghans that are there for various reasons right now that are still part of the government, still keeping the lights on in big cities. Also keep in mind, we're only seeing people flee from Kabul right now. There are a lot of Afghans who are in other parts of the country, big cities, including Mazar-e-Sharif and Herat and places like that. They're also trying to get out. And there are other ways to go through Uzbekistan or Tajikistan or even Iran for those that are for the Hazara community that can cross the border there. So there are ways for Afghans to get out. But you made the point that I think is so crucial. And the Taliban are worried about this, frankly, which is how do we keep the people who have been running this country in the streets, you know, picking up trash, the electricity. Winter is not all that far away. And this is a country that even in the best of times has struggled with electricity and just sort of keeping the lights on. And in the last couple of years, you've really seen a huge economy develop that was outside of the military industrial war economy across the entire country. And the Taliban are going to have to find a way to keep those lights on. And they need the Afghans that have been doing that to stay there. They're going to have to find a way to do that. And we were just talking earlier with some friends about whether or not, you know, the Taliban are likely to keep the mobile phone service going. And my thinking is that they're going to have to find a way to do that because all of these young Talib fighters, you know, they're used to having their mobile phones and sort of modern technology and the internet. There are things that are haram and things
right.
that are not allowed.
They're not as medieval. They're not as medieval as they seem. A lot of people think, oh, for heaven's sake, they haven't even got a phone. Oh, they have those capacities. They're using those capacities. I've got direct reporting about digital communications that have led people to hunt down former people who have worked with the U.S. forces to find them through the digital trails. Hold that thought for a minute. Doug Hay, one of the issues that has been very cumbersome, let's say, has been what to do with those evacuees who have ended up in midway points like Qatar. And what we're hearing is that the State Department representatives who went over there to process them for their next flight to wherever they're going had no idea what they were about to get. They thought there'd be people coming off aircraft with paperwork, and that's not happening. There are babies being born, at least three that we know of now, mid-flight on the bellies, in the bellies of those C-17s. There are unaccompanied children being rushed out by others. There are people with extended families who bum-rushed planes or who just got on with whatever documentation they had. Can we fix this? Do we have the capacity to deal with it and not make another humanitarian crisis at a second site?
Well, my concern is not only will we have a humanitarian crisis at a second site, but as we process people here, we will have the obvious problems that we've had with refugees and immigration issues in the past where our politics get very ugly very quickly. We've got to do two things. One, we've got to figure out who people are, where families are, because certainly there are some family separation happening as well. Get them back together, get the paperwork that they need, do the digital trail if we need to. And then as we try and relocate people throughout the country, what are the communities that are going to be most accepting of Afghan refugees, and where can we get them into those communities so that they can start living a normal life again after such a tough time, not just in the past 2 weeks, but 2 years and beyond?
God forbid you start hearing, you know, thanks for helping us out these last 20 years, but, you know, not in my backyard. You know, Michael Isikoff, what does all of this, all of these images, all of these videos, all of this do to American exceptionalism?
Well, look, there's no papering over the fact that this is a huge setback for the United States on the international stage. I mean, most immediately look at our NATO allies and how critical they have been about the way this had rolled out. Remember, you know, they had come to our aid after September 11th by sending troops and personnel to Afghanistan. They stood by us, and then to essentially be sort of virtually ignored when we get out, exposing their own people, was a humiliation and really dented America's image, I think, among our closest allies. But more broadly, I think there is a real there's something real about the way this has energized jihadis around the world. I mentioned that before in the first block. And that's a real that's a real national security concern that I think we're going to have to be dealing with for quite some time.
Yeah, I think that is an understatement of the evening and of the week and maybe of the last 20 years. Michael Isikoff, thank you. Doug High, Connor Powell, and Steve Russell, to all four of you, I couldn't have assembled a better Powell to work through these issues. I hope I can have you all back early and often. Still to come. Commercial flights here in the United States. Hard to make this transition, actually, but they are scary in a completely different way, to the point where the FAA has been throwing out those fines in the tens of thousands to unruly passengers. It's gone up to $1 million now in fines for all this bad behavior you've been seeing. And that only covers the things that happened this year: groping, fighting, even using cocaine on the plane. What happened to flying the friendly skies? What is this all about? Welcome back to Banfield. $1 million. That is how much the Federal Aviation Administration, or the FAA, has fined those naughty passengers you keep seeing. And by the way, that's just for 2021. And we're what, 8 months in? You know the people I'm talking about, right? You see them in these videos all the time. They're the people making everybody's day stink. That seems like a heck of a lot of money. So we wanted to track down the list just to see how bad the infractions were and how much they had to pay for their bad behavior. Some of the fines are for passengers refusing to wear a mask, but lots of the fines for some pretty serious stuff. Like this first example, a $45,000 fine. This was a person who was throwing luggage at other passengers, lying in the aisle, fondling one of the flight attendants, and then just for good measure went and stuck his head up the skirt of a flight attendant. Another fine, $32,000, for a passenger who allegedly beat up his seatmate because the seatmate refused to switch seats. And a third fine, $42,000, someone who threatened other passengers, threw a playing card at someone, and then snorted a substance that appeared to be cocaine. Yes, all of that on board planes. I am joined by two people who know more airline policy better than anyone, in fact, commercial pilot Kathleen Bangs, and also the president of the largest airline passenger organization, FlyersRights.org, Paul Hudson. Thank you both for joining me. Coming out of that Afghanistan story where people are desperate to just get on a plane and sit in the belly of a cargo hold for how many hours, I can't believe Americans are in this state, that we're behaving this way with our privileged life. But we are, to the point where the FAA had to release this PSA. I'm going to play it for you. We'll talk on the other side. Take a look.
We got a disruptive customer in the back.
We declare an emergency. We'd like to divert.
The unruly passenger, we need to get off the airplane.
Do you need authorities on the ground?
Yeah.
Kathleen Bangs, I am embarrassed that this is a story here in the United States. We should all be embarrassed. But beyond embarrassment, pilots are afraid, and they're starting to request that they land because they are in danger. This is going to next level.
Well, you know, they say that so far they've racked up over $1 million in fines this year for unruly passengers. And really, what I would call that is just barely a good start. This is so overdue, especially what's been going on. But I do want to make the case that while it is a distraction, I wouldn't call it so much a danger, but it's definitely a distraction for the pilots. I want to make clear it is a danger for the cabin attendants, for the other people in the back. But, of course, you don't want your pilots distracted because they could miss something critical that's going on, a critical radio call, a critical decision. And so it's really about time that the FAA is stepping this up and hopefully getting the Justice Department involved, because the fines I don't know if they're going to be enough. You know, a lot of these people, they pull them off the airplane after punching a flight attendant, breaking her teeth, things like that. But then the local police, or the local sheriffs, they let them go. They don't want to hold them. So I don't even know if the fines are going to be enough to really turn this situation around.
So, Paul Hudson, I'm just looking at some of the FAA investigation numbers, and unruly reports so far this year have come in at 3,988. 3,988. And of that, 2,928 were reports of those refusing to wear a mask. I have a question for you. As the guy behind FlyersRights.org, look at those statistics on the screen and tell me, is this the airline's fault that this behavior has gotten out of hand, or is this the passenger's fault that this behavior's gotten out of hand?
Well, I think you got to look at both sides. The passengers are under a great deal of stress with COVID. The planes are now jammed again. There's no social distancing. And I must say that the scenes that you show are deplorable, and they certainly merit action by the FAA, if not the FBI. However, those are the exceptions, really. The vast majority of these cases involve a refusal to wear a mask, and we've questioned a number of the mask rules. The airlines don't want to allow any exceptions to masking, even though the CDC guidelines provide for it. The TSA, without any public input, extended the mask rule from May to September. And they added the fact that you're supposed to wear a mask now, even when you're eating and drinking. You can only take it off when you're between sips and bites. Now, there's no CDC guideline like that. And this big surge that we've seen in disruptive passengers largely is because of the masking situation and overcrowded planes.
So let me ask you this, Kathleen Bangs. Can I call you Captain Bangs? Is that still appropriate? Is that okay?
Well, I'm not currently flying for the airline, so Kathleen is fine.
All right. Well, Captain Kathleen. Okay. So $1 million in fines. Okay. That's a big number. But one thing that the airlines can't do is they can't bring criminal charges. And there's a lot of talk now about a liaising kind of body, much like the, you know, Securities and Exchange Commission that works hand in hand regarding criminal charges. Is that something that we're going to start seeing?
Well, it seems to me that we already have things in place. I think if you could get Congress maybe to act with the Department of Justice, there's certainly rules or things that could be used in place. But you're right, the FAA certainly can't do the prosecution. I do think also that these fines, I mean, if they could make them as fast as possible, like you get hauled off the jetway and you give them your credit card right there. I think if people saw some immediate pain, but they're getting away, you know, with some really, really disruptive, let's just call it violent behavior. And it certainly goes beyond the mask issue, which is a part of it. Alcohol has been involved in a lot of this, so many of the carriers aren't serving alcohol, but they're having to stop, you know, establishments at the airport concourses from kind of giving people alcohol to bring onto the plane with them. Not having alcohol would certainly do, you know, a little bit of improvement, but I think, you know, we have to get to kind of the bottom of this, that years ago, just going into the pandemic, we were hitting record numbers of flights domestically. And we saw maybe 100 to 200 cases a year like this, even though we were flying more people than we are now. And it's just gone up tremendously. I do think, obviously, what I saw, like how Delta Airlines certainly was at the beginning of the pandemic, where you had that open middle seat. I mean, that was fantastic. And I think people really started to feel like they were being treated a little better. I don't know if that's a workable business model, though, for many of the airlines, unfortunately, at this point.
Yeah. But I like the idea of instant fines, like really when you, with it, just can the consequences immediate. That's what I always say with my kids. And that's how we're behaving. Kathleen Bangs and Paul Hudson, thank you so much for your time this evening. Really appreciate it. Coming up after the break, a royal pain, an upcoming tell-all memoir by Prince Harry, reportedly has the royal family shaking in their royal boots. So much so that the Queen, I can't believe this, is lawyering up. Plus, while a grandson has gone rogue, the Queen is sticking by her son, Andrew. Even when her own military allegedly says, enough is enough, Your Highness. That's next. Harry claims he's been cut off financially from the royal family after packing his bags and moving to the U.S. But according to reports, the Queen could be taking things a step further by sicking the legal dogs on her grandson, threatening to sue over his upcoming tell-all memoir if it tells a little too much. All this while the Queen remains very loyal to her son, Andrew, the Duke of York, reportedly to her military's chagrin. Joining us now is royal watcher Hilary Fordich, and also with us, prosecutor Stacey Honowitz, who specializes in sex crimes and child abuse. Okay, Hilary Fordich, let me ask you this. Andrew, as I understand it, is the colonel of the Grenadier Guards. Sounds very fancy. So what's the problem?
Well, actually, he has four other titles as well. He's also with the RAF. He's also a Commander-in-Chief of the Fleet Air Command, and he also has a Yorkshire Grenadier. So he's also in many other military positions. The issue is more that many of the military leaders, of course, can't see how someone that has stepped back from military duties can actually then not perform them and still keep the titles and retain those titles. Actually, Prince Andrew did a very good job initially. The Grenadier Guards were really happy with him at their helm before all these scandals broke. But now, of course, he's persona non grata. And this has not sat well because the military, particularly the RAF, the Royal Air Force, as well as the Grenadier Guards and the Yorkshires as well, they all have very high standards. And this doesn't look good, and it doesn't bode well for how he will be perceived in relation to those units. And so the leaders of each of those defense organizations have basically made themselves known to the Queen that they don't like this. They don't want him as their helm anymore.
My great uncles, Ms. Fordwich, would be rolling in their grave. They were members of the RAF. So to hear all of this happen. So let me ask you, Stacey Honowitz, about some of the legal wranglings that we're hearing about right now, with sources saying that the Queen has actually assembled a legal team with their sights set on Penguin Random House that's publishing Harry's book. This is what one of the British reports says from a palace aide. If someone were named in the book and accused of something directly, that could be a libel there and also infringe on their rights to a private family life. Okay. The way I see it, and call me crazy, is that it's really hard to libel a super duper highly placed public figure like the Queen. The bar is very high. And then when it comes to your rights to a private family life, what rights do you have with regard to a memoir? Help me out.
Well, we all know, I mean, she's a public figure. I mean, she is worldwide. I mean, everybody knows who the Queen is. And certainly, if you go back, there have been a million things written about the Queen and written about the family. So it will be very difficult to try to prove that they've infringed on her private rights. And, you know, in any kind of libel, any kind of slander, any kind of suit like that, we have to show actual malice when it's against a public figure. There's been such a historical events about her in television, in movies, in books, that this kind of theory that there's going to be an infringement of her rights, I think, is going to be very difficult. I think for now, it's kind of a threat. Like, if you go too far, here's what we're going to do. We saw Meghan Markle do it. We see everybody always gets the lawyers involved. But just because you get the lawyer involved doesn't mean that there's ever going to be a suit down the line. And I think this would be very difficult.
Sometimes it's just saber rattling. I hear you. Hilary Fordwich, the other reports that are coming out of the palace, and man, they're just tumbling out daily, is that the Queen has actually allowed Andrew to have armed security, even though he's given up his royal duties. And I seem to recall Harry saying that he and Meghan lost a lot of their security after they stepped back from duties. This doesn't seem to square very nicely.
No, you're right about that. But I will say it's under the blanket of the trip to Balmoral. And don't forget, also, Prince Andrew lives on the grounds of Windsor Great Park. So that's a huge difference. Whereas Prince Harry, of course, and Meghan, they opted to go first to Canada as their stepping stone and then to LA. So they've really divested themselves of the royal family. They wanted to step down. They wanted their privacy, although, of course, they went to Los Angeles and hired three PR firms. But Prince Andrew at the moment lives basically permanently in the grounds of Windsor Castle. And while he's up at Balmoral, yes, they all have security in those locations. And all, basically, as you just mentioned, linking this up and to the last story, because he stepped back from his
high-profile position, and he's no longer a working senior royal, he doesn't have security at those occasions because he's not participating anymore. So it's a very low-key life, and so within those grounds, it's far more possible. That's the difference.
You know, you two are great. I look at these stories and I sort of think, really? But then, yeah, I guess really. This is the institution, after all, right? It's not just a royal family. It's a big old business. So thank you so much, Hillary Fordwich. And what's that, Stacey? Say it again.
You know, she's, you know, everyone says, like, why is she backing Andrew? Why? She's still the mother. I mean, I see in all these criminal cases, I could have the worst criminals come into court, but the mother is always sitting there and the mother's always going to back. You can't expect that family is going to turn on him. So it's not a surprise that she is sticking by him.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You've seen a few of them. I know, Stacey. Moms are moms no matter what. Stacey, Hillary, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Pleasure.
In other news from across the pond, it is truly the end of an era. Before our break, we want to say goodbye to Charlie Watts, drummer for the Rolling Stones. Listen to this. Yeah. Remember that riff? He was with them since 63, and he died this morning at the age of 80. No cause of death cited, but his cause in life was clear, making music, amazing music, for close to six decades. So rest in peace, Charlie Watts. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes. Got an update now on the story I brought you last night about my Afghan interpreter and the digital Dunkirk I was involved in to get his family out of Afghanistan. They have now spent their third day in limbo in Qatar, and it has not been easy. And don't forget, everybody they left behind as well, also selling all their worldly goods now on the streets of Kabul. I don't know if you've seen these pictures. Everybody just emptying out their homes and selling everything before they know they leave forever. It's really just a heartbreaking scene. I also want to show you some exclusive reporting. The brother-in-law of my interpreter, Jawad, sent us this report from the hangar in Qatar where they're staying with some of the conditions. Have a look.
We are here in Qatar. The situation is not good. There are women and children with us. Shower and bathroom conditions are really bad. This place is fully crowded with people, and more people keep coming. We don't know how long we might remain in this holding area.
Temperatures have reached up to 106 degrees in Qatar. It has been extraordinarily uncomfortable, but we are hoping to give you good news soon of them getting an evacuation flight out of there and hopefully to be reunited with Jawad, my interpreter. I did give the GoFundMe information last night. It's Jawad-Rescue if you want to help out, and keep your eyes out because there are people coming here who need our help. Thanks, everyone, for watching tonight. We'll see you right back here tomorrow for Banfield.